Into True Wealth, your tangible assets advisor. I'm Kevin, your host, sponsored by Coins Plus in Spokane. Coins Plus, as always, is your full-service rare coin and precious metals broker, dealer, and depository service. And you all know what we do. We buy and sell all forms of coins and precious metals. We specialize, our highest volume, obviously, is in the gold and silver. But we also buy estates, accumulations, and things like that. We go through horrendous volumes of coins, and occasionally we get, you know, we buy good quality stuff from good collections and estates. That's the stuff that we put together and highly recommend for our investors. A lot of people don't understand. They think they want to collect coins or invest. They will literally go online and buy things that they shouldn't, or TV is the worst. Telephone solicitors. I think I mentioned the other day, listened to a radio commercial where they're pitching MS-70 American Gold Eagles, and they explain that grading goes from 0 to 70, and these are perfect. Whenever you hear something like that, that means they're going to charge you too much for it. When you're buying a bullion coin, okay, here's the logic. People say, you know, I want bullion, I don't want a collectible coin. And yet, they will go buy a bullion coin that somebody says, oh, but this is perfect. It's an MS-70. It's certified, and they'll pay way too much. A bullion coin is a bullion coin is a bullion coin. That means that it's always going to be worth its intrinsic value, nothing more, nothing less, period. If that, you know, if you're going to buy bullion, you don't pay premiums for bullion coins. And that's the whole point. If you want something that's got upside potential, a collectible, we sell semi-numismatic coins. Some people think, I don't want to be into collectibles. Well, the logic that we use is, you know, there are a lot of coins that are hypothetically, very debatably collectible, and yet they have little to no premium at this point in time. Historically, they've had extraordinary premiums. I've mentioned, you know, the U.S. $20 gold pieces. Not only have just the generic circulated versions, which, by the way, have about an ounce of gold in them, they're almost a carbon copy of the modern American Eagle. The modern American Eagle is a one-ounce bullion coin. The old The modern American Eagle is a one-ounce American bullion coin. It's got a $50 face value. It's very much like a remake of the old St. Gaudens, okay? The St. Gaudens was a $20 gold piece. It had about an ounce of gold in it. And then it has some alloys to harden it. So it's an ounce of gold plus the alloys. People get confused. They'll have an ounce of gold plus a tenth ounce of silver. The tenth ounce of silver is to harden the coin because it was made for circulation. They still do that in the bullion coins today. It's just a tradition in making coins. So the modern American Eagle's a $50 face, 1 ounce. The old $20 gold piece is $20 face, 1 ounce. The antique coins, and we're talking the St. Gaudens were made from 1908 till about 19... They were made from 1908 to 1933. The 1933s are ridiculously rare. There's a dozen known, and the government claims no one's supposed to own them, says that they were all stolen, which isn't true. That's a story for another day. But the St. Gaudens you would buy will range from 1908 to 1927. My point is that the St. Gaudens, the old 1 ounce bullion coin, the collectible, when the gold standard was $20 an ounce, they're trading right now at a small premium, like 10% over what the bullion coin trades for. But they've been up to 500% over. And in addition to that, when you get a little nicer quality, as we've said, the grading goes from 0 to 70. Once you get into mint state uncirculated grading, that starts at 60 and up. 0 is basal state. You can barely identify what the coin ever was, and then the grading goes up basically by 4s is the convenient way. By the time you get to mint state uncirculated, that's a 60, and then from 60 to 70 is higher grades of mint state. 70 never exists on antique coins. They did not have the quality control. They did not have the ability. There was just far too much going on. The planchets weren't perfect, which is fine. That's man-made stuff. It's actually cool. It's got a ton of personality. That's what you love about them. their hand-carved dies. They made the St. Gaudens is arguably the most beautiful coin ever made in the history of the world. That's a lot of people say that, along with the Walking Liberty half dollar, which has now been copied on the new American Silver Eagle bullion coin. So my point is this. You can get the old double eagles often now in the within 10% of the bullion coin. They're too cheap. There's great value there. They're collectible. They're rare. They can't make anymore. That's why you buy that stuff. And to be quite frank, as I basically explain this to you, I'll also explain that the supply of this stuff is getting difficult at best. We sell a ton of it. People prefer semi-numismatic over bullion all day long, and they're even starting to prefer a nice piece of their portfolio in quality, hand-picked numismatic coins. You know, you can get things like I just did a portfolio for a gal with a, you know, like a 1794 U.S. half cent. You know, the stuff that was circulating around when George Washington and Ben Franklin and all these people, these are the coins they used. You can get into early silver dollars from the late 1700s. You know, there's a lot of neat coins that are a very important part of Americana. And, the coins are the history of a country. And America had really neat stuff. I mean, we took pride in what we did. We had the 13 stars, the 13 arrows, you know, the Union Shield. I mean, we made neat stuff. There's Civil War era stuff. And, you know, you can almost feel like you're there when you're looking at this stuff, because it's got a look, you know. Lady Liberty has a look. All of our old coins have Lady Liberty on them. Liberty, liberty, liberty is what they wanted. Freedom. That was the big battle. And to be candid with you, you know, I did some, I watched a movie here recently. They call it The Free State of Jones, which basically integrates five different eras, five different episodes over about a 30-year period, you know, starting with the Civil War, and then, you know, all the struggle over the emancipation, and then eventually, you know, where they made the false apprenticeship laws, which were basically they made these phony laws to replace slavery laws, and they basically gave the landowners the same rights, and that led to the military reconstruction, where we were put under martial law, supposedly to institute racist protection or protection against racial laws. The truth of the matter is, if you study history, that's not the case at all. History has made this all about the emancipation of the slaves, and really, honestly, nothing could be further from the truth. I was a big Abraham Lincoln fan for years, and I started to think about, as I learned more about history and what was going on around the time, and I started to understand some of the stuff that was taking place around the Civil War, I started questioning some of this stuff and saying, you know, how does this make sense? I mean, how could this be tolerated? How could Abraham Lincoln tolerate this? And how could he stand by and watch the methodical slaughter of 700,000 adult males in America and not shed a tear. I mean, not shed a tear. And as I began to dig into history, I began to discover that if you read the words of Abraham Lincoln, you suddenly see a different president than history has told us who we are. A quote, you know, he's basically, he was stuck on preserving the Union, okay? Well, the problem is this was our first introduction of a technically a tyrannical totalitarian regime. The South was very constitutional. They really wanted states' freedom. It was all about states' freedom. Racism and slavery was an issue, but as I'll go over here, much of that had been completely resolved already. And other parts of it, you know, they were trying to institute legislation to prevent it from ever being resolved. In both cases, Abraham Lincoln was involved with the laws that were, you know, going to permanently enslave the African Americans. And then on the other hand, the laws that had already been passed for a progressive release or progressive emancipation, he was aware of. So long story short, the historical account of Abraham Lincoln just being about freeing the slaves is incorrect. It's sad, but it's true, and it's just the way it is. And there's a lot of, there's like a historical worship of him that says he went to war to free the slaves. You know, the racial injustice at the time was terrible, and the desire to abolish slavery played no role in Abraham Lincoln's determination to strangle the Confederacy. One factor that Lincoln's determination to preserve the Union at any one, the one factor for Lincoln was, he said, to preserve the Union at any cost, which basically cost the lives of literally hundreds of thousands of people. In 1862, Lincoln wrote to Horace Greeley, who was the leading Northern newspaper man of the day. And a quote that he wrote says, "My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and it is not either to save or destroy slavery." He said, "If I could save the Union without freeing any slaves, I would do it." So he's basically saying, you know, for me, it has nothing to do with slavery. And in 1861, Congress resolved that the purpose of the war was not to, quote, "interfere with the rights or establish institutions of any state." Okay, so they were saying they're not trying to abuse the constitutional right of a state. They said, and then the quote goes on, "but to preserve the Union with the rights of the several states unimpaired." So on the day that, you know, the hostilities began at Fort Sumter, only the seven states of the Deep South had seceded. There were more slaves within the Union, that's the North where Abraham Lincoln was, than outside of it. And Lincoln hadn't expressed the slightest intention to free any of these slaves. There was a book written in 1835 by Alex de Tocqueville, Democracy in America, and he said, "The prejudice of race appears to be stronger in the states that have abolished slavery than in those where it exists." So another factor that motivated the war was the Republican Party's, at the time, desire to tax and spend, which is kind of ironic when you think back and you think of what we're all about. They were on this idea of tax and spend. I mean, this Abraham Lincoln, folks, was a critical turning point. And I wonder sometimes if Obama knows this, because Obama says that Abraham Lincoln is one of his great heroes, mentors. And the true Abraham Lincoln is nothing like we think. You know, we think of the Republican Party is a party of small government and limited, you know, taxation and all this. And at the time, the Republican Party was the opposite, which is really bizarre, because the term republic in and of itself is, you know, all about the law, not about you know, the socialist mindset. Sorry about that. I think you heard my cell phone go off there. But so at the time, the Republicans were kind of the party of big government. And in Lincoln's time, they championed a high tariff. They used the proceeds, which were laundered through roads, canals, and railways, to dispense lavish corporate welfare to their backers. You know, and it kind of goes on and on like that. Lincoln threatened to invade any state that failed to collect federal duties and imposts. And he rationalized his order to blockade southern ports on the grounds that the collection of the revenue cannot be effectually executed in the states that had seceded. Things were a lot messier than we realize. He said at one time, Here's a quote that in one of his debates with Stephen Douglas in 1858 when he was running for president. Like many and perhaps most other men of his time and place, Lincoln was an unapologetic and irredeemable racist. I mean, we throw the term racist around now, folks, so loosely, and it is so pathetic. It is so pathetic. These people viewed African Americans as animals, and worse. They treated their animals better than a lot of them treated slaves. Now, there are many, many, many stories of people that treated their slaves with grace and kindness, but you cannot own a child of God. I mean, you cannot own a human. A human is just not meant to be owned, in my opinion. And I know there's cultural norms and differences, but a human is not meant to be owned. So Lincoln at one time in the debate said, "I, as well as Judge Douglas, who he was running against, am in favor of the race to which I belong, having the superior position," in other words, the white race. He then added, "Free them slaves and make them politically and socially our equals. No, that would make them our enemies." He said, "My own feelings will not admit of this." In other words, he won't even think about the concept of freeing the slaves. He said, "We cannot then ever consider making them our equals." That's a pretty strong statement. So I could go on, you know, he says, I will to the very last stand by the law of this state. So basically, I guess I can back up. Anyone who studies history accurately cannot deny Lincoln's staunch, vociferous advocacy of apartheid-style racism and white supremacy. Yes, it was cultural. Yes, you know, it was the times, and it's easy to look back and judge. You know, it's sad, but it was. I mean, it was. Yes, it was part of reality at the time. But he said, in 1858, when he was running for president, I believe, "What I would most desire would be the separation of the white and black races." And then in his fourth debate with Douglas, he vowed, "I will, to the very last stand, by the law of this state, which forbids the marrying of white people with Negroes, uphold that law and never disavow the superiority of our race." Lincoln enthusiastically supported the Illinois Constitution, which at the time prohibited the emigration of black people into the state. He also backed the infamous Illinois Black Codes, which deprived the small number of free blacks residing within the state any semblance of citizenship, and he applauded what they called the Fugitive Slave Act, which compelled Northerners to capture runaway slaves and return them to their owners or to face death if they knew of a runaway slave and did not apprehend them. I mean, wow. Okay, so I think you can see the point. There's more quotes here I could go through. I don't know that I need to. I mean, one other thing, in his first inaugural address, Lincoln proposed to make the constitutional amendment express and irrevocable that said that the U.S. government would never hinder the state's rights to hold people involuntarily to labor or service as long as it followed the laws of that state. He was a lifelong advocate of colonization, which was to ship all the black people back to Africa, Central America, Haiti, anywhere other than the U.S. He said, "I cannot make it better known than it already is," he stated in a message when he was talking to Congress in 1862, "that I strongly favor colonization." And he favored it so strongly that he was the president of the Illinois Colonization Society. And I guess to Abraham Lincoln, the way people view him now, in his, you know, according to his actions and words, Abraham Lincoln, from his perspective, African Americans could never be equal once they had. The only way they could be equal is to be expelled and colonized somewhere else. We created Liberia for the purpose of colonization. There was an argument at the time that Rome had been brought down by the barbarians. The barbarians were the slaves of Rome, and they had eventually received their emancipation, their freedom. And once they did, they put so much political pressure on Rome that they got Roman citizenship, which was usually the privilege of the ultra-uber elite and wealthy. And the way it worked is kind of like in that movie, The Hunger Games, or the books, where they use the districts. They take tribute from the districts to feed Rome, and then the Roman citizens don't have to work. Well, barbarians got Roman citizenship. In other words, it was never enough. And then we hear about the bread and circuses, where the Roman emperors had to entertain these people and feed them. And as long as he kept them fat and happy, they wouldn't cause harm. Well, the barbarians were filled with bitterness and resentments and a vengeful spirit, and eventually they took Rome to the ground, and all they had to do is move north back to their homeland. And so a lot of our founding fathers were aware of this. The earlier, I guess they weren't the founding fathers, but some of the early American patriarchs. And that's the one logic behind colonization was, hey, let's get them out of here. That will prevent later acts of revenge. You know, it may sound racist, but it might have been. It's not a bad idea. We created Liberia with the sole intent of moving them there. We actually created, at the time, a wonderfully developed country with a very strong infrastructure that they could have gone to. But, you know, that never came to full fruition. But the moral of the story there is simple. The fact is that history gets rewritten drastically. And Abraham Lincoln was the first one to create fiat currency, where he basically was robbing the kitty of the future to fund this war, which was more tyrannical than anything. The desire of the southern states to secede was being caused by the pressure from the north, to basically disrespect their constitutional rights as individual states, to impose taxes and tariffs on them that weren't reasonable or regular, and, to start to tamper with direct taxation. We, in this country, our Constitution forbids direct taxation, Article 1, Section 9, we cannot be taxed, or we are not to constitutionally be taxed, according to our God-given ability to earn an income. They considered that slavery at the time. And yet, over time, we began this socialist mindset, which obviously began to have a great effect on the history of this country. And so I think it's just important to understand that, sadly, America needs to adapt. I mean, that is the point of our Constitution. People that are hardcore constitutional, staunchly constitutional, will try to, not flex, not budge. We're in a different place today. There's definite adaptations that were necessary. Ironically, one of the worst things that happened globally was in 1848, the publishment of the Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx. Karl Marx was born in 1818. By the age of 30, he had published this pamphlet called the Communist Manifesto. And since then, other than Christ, I believe that Karl Marx's pamphlet, the Communist Manifesto, has had probably the greatest effect on worldly governments than anything else. It has, it affected the thought process even by the 1860s, the Civil War. The effect of the Communist Manifesto, and you got to remember back then, there were not a lot of writings to choose from. Books were rare, they were hard to find, people were very limited. Somebody picked up the Communist Manifesto and they mass produced it globally. So by 1850, this thing had covered the globe. People back in the United States, they were very well read and they were very philosophical. And but at the same time, they had lost, you know, good grounding and roots on the U.S. Constitution. And a lot of them had come to a point where there had been so much corruption and broken banks. I mean, the history of banks is another story. You know, we had the wildcat banks and state banks. And first we had the wildcat banks. Those were the private banks. And they basically collapsed and took everybody's money. So the states took over and created their own banks. And then they issued their own currency. Well, once again, they went bankrupt and took everybody's money. So people were fed up. They were bitter. They were tired of the system. They were tired of the establishment. When the state takes all your money, okay, your own state in false currency, it makes you angry at the government or the establishment. Even though it wasn't the Fed that did it, it made them act out against all governments. So they were really fed up. They were really tired of it. They didn't want it. And then because of it, they were very, very receptive to Karl Marx's, Communist Manifesto. Starting in about 1837, we had the free banking era, and that is when we had the state banks and so on. And, you know, the states had supposed reserve requirements, and they had banknotes that were supposedly backed by gold and silver, and they were supposed to have ratios of capital to loans and paper money, all this stuff. But what do you do when a state bank abuses that, prints money like it's going out of style, all the gold and silver disappears, and they go broke? We didn't have federal bailouts back then. Now we bail it out. The Federal Reserve System is so flawed, folks. They can just fire up the printing presses, which is what you and I understand. But although the truth of it now is they can't because it's all cyber dollars. But now they just create money out of thin air, and they do these bailouts. Well, every time they do it, it's more monopoly money in the system. Back then, the money was just gone. Okay, yes, back then, somebody walked away with it, and that was a serious problem. There was a lot of white-collar crime that people got away with. Some people got incredibly rich from it. The consequences were null and void because they had so much money. They were buying everybody off. So people were fed up. They were fed up, and they wanted money to be shared. They wanted to be bailed out. They wanted their government to do something good for them. And this is where the receptiveness towards socialism came into play. Some argue that the battle between the North and the South was the battle between socialism and constitutionalism. And if you study the history of it, I know the North won the war, and you know how that goes. The victor gets to write the history. And so we've been taught the country that we live in, which, believe me, has some very, very positive attributes, do not get me wrong. But when you look at the power and magnitude of our federal government and law enforcement and the way they destroy and with, you know, without impugn, with absolutely no consequence, this all began under Abraham Lincoln. Once the Civil War closed out, we had, as I said, we had the military reconstruction. That's where the Union Army made, you know, martial law. They put military control over all the states, at least that within access range where the heavy populations were, and they forced them to obey the law. There were so many things going on back then. The runaway taxes during the Civil War, they had these. They allowed the generals to go around and essentially take, quote, 10% of everybody's money to fund the war. Well, they would go into people's houses. They would take everything. They would take all their grain. You know, these people would work all year to grow corn, and they would store their corn. And then they would use their corn to feed their livestock, to feed their hogs, to feed their cattle, to feed whatever they wanted. Back then, there was a lot of hogs, a lot of pigs. So winter comes, and the military would also steal their hogs and slaughter their pigs. They'd leave these people broke and destitute. They'd take all their cotton. They'd take everything of value, far more than 10%. They'd take 100%. And then what they would do, if people tried to disobey, guess what? They literally would be publicly executed. I mean, very bad things. And they would kill people. They would systematically, legally kill citizens. This is also where they would occupy people's homes without permission. You know, just on and on it went. So people were getting fed up with the government. The concept by this point was a little bit of a runaway socialism by the Civil War, because we had adapted a socialistic mentality. Pay your fair share was a phrase that we've all heard that became very popular, you know, for people to pay their taxes, pay your fair share. That actually began on the president after Andrew Jackson. I can't remember who succeeded him, but he's the one that started to say that, and that became a real popular phrase that we hear now from the Socialist Party. So I know I've kind of bounced around on that a little bit, but you just have to understand that that period of time in America was true mayhem and chaos. We had lost our minds. We were beginning socialist activity. We had seen, I've mentioned the riots in New York. There was very little benefit of the federal government at the time. They didn't offer protection. They didn't offer roads. They didn't, you know, the mail post office was a private company. All these things, you know, there was no benefit to the money that they were taking. They were just using the money to build their kiddies and to build their own real estate in their capital cities in the U.S. government. So after the Civil War, after Abraham Lincoln had his way, you know, racism is, as the quote we read earlier said, you know, after the war, the northern states, which are, you know, supposedly the ones that have outlawed slavery, they were technically some of the worst of all. And to be a black individual at that time was terrible. We were a Caucasian country. I realized that. But the Africans, you know, they've had a very tough history. I mean, I'll just put it that way. I don't know why that is. There's all kinds of theories on that. I can't really help you with that, but I do know it's been brutally tough. And they always seem to be at the center of abuse, violence, and things like that. So as we progressed out of the Civil War, we'd lost our entire adult male population and young men too. I mean, they were gutting. The actual census records of who died have been redone, I think, about 13 years ago, and they came up with another 200 and some thousand men that disappeared off the rosters. The other thing was the slaves that died. There was a tremendous number of black men that were forced to fight in the war that had no birth record. There was no record of them. And there's been different theories on the total number of losses, but it truly is outstanding. So after that, the country was in serious repair, reparations, and the government convinced everybody to pay, you know, temporary taxes to help repair this, and the government would seize these assets and that. And we went into it was a real downtime in the country. And by 1890, late 80s, we'd gone into, actually by the 1880s, you know, to be honest, It really was bad all along. But the Depression became more and more paramount through the 1880s into 1890. People were sick and tired of it, and then, you know, they blamed it on centralized banking. Same old thing. You know, we watched this big mess, this financial chaos in 2008. Who do they blame? The banks. Well, the truth of the matter is, it was the result of Abraham Lincoln forwarding so much fiat currency to fund the Civil War, he bankrupted the future of this nation. That is the problem with fiat currency. You are not taking money that you have today. You're taking money from the future, okay? And if you think about it, if you live on cash and cash alone and you never use credit, if you buy something and it just straps your family for a period of time, once it passes, it passes. You're done. You're back to zero. You've got whatever you've purchased and accumulated, and you've got no debt. However, if you use debt to buy something, you might struggle to get the item. It might be easier, but you might struggle a little. But then you owe that debt over time, and it just continues to chew away at you, and you're never truly free from it. So this was the result of the Civil War. It led us into an absolute dark slump in the 1890s. People were fed up. Believe it or not, they wanted to decentralize banking. They'd seen, in their opinion, banks had gone upside down and defunct and taken all their money. So through a period of illusion over a 20-year period of time and the onset of Marxism mentality, by 1900, the concept of Marxism, socialism, communism had run amok. People thought it was the greatest thing. There was no historical precedent of what happens under communism. Communism requires tyrannical rule and an absolute fleecing of the people. It's completely contrary to the way we were created. We do have the Jonestown colony experiment where we know that that blew up. And then when they changed it back to a capitalistic system where men can own free land and harvest their own property, their own crops, all of a sudden things began to flourish. We knew that. But, you know, time erases the memory. So people were demanding decentralization of the banks. So over a 20-year period of time, this great deception was being put into their mind until finally we get to the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, which technically centralized banking at the greatest level in the history of the world. But they were actually able to deceive the population to think it was the opposite. They didn't think of the Federal Reserve Bank as a bank. They thought of it as a large government institution that was now going to regulate the value of currency. Because after all, right, Congress was supposed to value the, dictate the value thereof, or whatever it says in the Constitution and the Coinage Act 1792. And they got people to bite off. The Republicans tried to push it through a few times. Some of the richest men in the world drafted it at Jekyll Island, which, by the way, if you want the best synopsis of the history of money globally in the world and the history of money in America, you've got to read the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. It is written in a beautiful way. You can buzz through the entire book in an hour or two by just reading the introduction and summary of every chapter, and even the author said this. You can go back later to get the substantive corroborative evidence that he lays out in the book, but in general, his overview is sufficient to give you an idea what took place. And it is astounding. It is an ongoing act of fraud that is so far beyond your comprehension. But it also helps you to understand why we are where we at today. You know, where are we going? What's the history of our behavior? How many bailouts have we done? What have been the effects of them? The book is very, very good. And if you want a really good basis on firm, foundational, fundamental constitutional economics, and the history thereof, this book is terrific. We do sell it. I think they're like $24. They're a very thick book. Please don't try to read the whole thing. First, just do the summary chapter thing like I discussed. And so, of course, by 1913, they'd been unable to institute the Federal Reserve. People could see the truth. Then they actually bribed some Democrats, and one more was a populist named William Bryan Jennings or something like that. I usually know it, and I forgot right now. And they conned him to come on board, and then he got in the main people. You know, he deceived them and pulled them in. And they basically didn't object. When Congress had an emergency meeting on December 24th, Christmas Eve of 1913, with only 11 members of Congress, ramming through this Federal Reserve Act. From that point forward, they took over. They began to produce currency like it was going out of style. They ran it alongside gold and silver-backed notes because people had been fed a book of lies, and they had to continue to have notes that were, you know, backed by the metals on paper so people didn't freak out and try to go get them. For a while, they let people withdraw the metals until the crash of 29. The crash of 29 was caused by a symbiotic relationship between severe hyperinflation and a continued allowance of the gold and silver standard to circulate. They had created 33 times the notes that were backed by gold as we had gold in reserves. So they gave people the impression that every dollar they were carrying was backed by gold. The truth is only one out of every $33 they were carrying was backed by gold. And then eventually they did a major currency retraction because, according to them, we had hyperinflation, and so that they had to make a deflationary move by restricting the flow of currency, by tightening the money standards. They had introduced for the first time in the history of the United States lending-based monetary policy. No one before had ever used debt, basically, only on the smallest scales. Now, at this time, every dollar was debt. Every business was run by debt. People were in debt up to their necks. They were leveraging and margining everything. J.P. Morgan, who owned Wall Street, and he created the Dow Jones and all this to defeat people, he also invented what was called margin accounts, where you could borrow up to, at the time, almost a full amount of your stock portfolio to buy more stock. So if you had, at the time, $10,000 in stock, they would loan you another $10,000 to buy more stock. And it was a loan. It was, you were paying interest on it, but everybody thought things were great and they were never going to go bad, just like they did with real estate in the 2008 bubble. Well, when the market crashed, men didn't only lose all they had. They went into levels of debt they knew they could never repay because these margin calls came in and left them literally destitute. And so the government came in with the attitude like, look, we know you're in a pickle and we're going to be your savior. Well, the problem with that is the government was the cause of the problem and the solution. It's called Hegelian dialectic. It's thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Hitler was a master at it. Many of the world's great leaders have utilized it. They create a problem. They present the problem. And then they happen to make themselves look like they discover or present the solution. And then they become a hero. This is sort of what happened to FDR. People got the union mentality. I wouldn't have a job if it wasn't for FDR. I love FDR. This is what they would say. FDR had the fireside chats every week on the radio. You have to remember, there was no TVs. There was no other technology. If you turned on the radio, most times you got dead air. There were some radio stations that would play music. You can imagine the sound quality was terrible. People did not know any better. But basically, he controlled the airwaves. He controlled the newspapers. His best friends owned all the major newspapers. And he made it impossible for anyone to ever run against him. And he literally was gaining more and more control on this country. and I believe his chief of staff was William Sheehy, and they had drafted up an executive order that would make FDR a permanent dictator, okay? Because after all, he knew best, right? This was the mentality of arrogance, that the people needed him and he knew best. And then he died, and immediately both houses of Congress, the Senate and the House, and both parties within a week or two passed new legislation that created term limits on the presidential seat to 2 terms, because they were so afraid. Both sides had seen what almost happened with FDR. But with FDR's implementation and institution of a countless number of what I would call alphabet soup organizations, in other words, FBI, DEA, EPA, that's alphabet soup to me. And he created so many of these, it was irreparable. Very similar. You know, Obama says FDR was his mentor. Very similar to Obamacare and whatnot. We have Obama out right now screaming on the campaign trail, "Don't let me down. This guy's a moron," talking of Trump. "If you want to give me a good sending off, you need to vote for Hillary Clinton. If you vote for Trump, that will destroy my legacy." And he's right, because Donald Trump will get in office and he will repeal Obamacare. And I actually believe Donald Trump said he would repeal and replace. I actually believe that he's a man of his word. I mean, we have no indicator that Donald Trump is a liar, contrary to what the media has presented to people, so that a very high percentage of people don't trust Donald Trump. A higher percentage don't trust Hillary Clinton, but that's understandable. She's got a track record of absolute deceit and corruption, and it's nice to know so many people see it. The biggest problem is the Democratic Party has single-handedly gathered up the African-American community. They've done nothing for them. They keep them in poverty. They promise them the world and deliver nothing. You would really ask yourself, Donald Trump, he's brash, he's rude, he's a New Yorker at the core. But what, you know, as Donald Trump says, what do you got to lose by hiring him, by electing him as president? We know what we're going to get with Hillary. And then Obama and Hillary are brilliant. They're coming out after Trump, you know, basically was repeating the words of Obama, where Obama blamed Bush, you know, for everything and said the country's horrible. Trump comes out and echoes it, and then all of a sudden the Democrats are like, no, 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 no. It's wonderful. It's great. Life is good. There's nothing wrong. And they ignore the fact that, you know, welfare's at an all-time high, home ownership's at an all-time low, you know, wages, real wages have gone down. I mean, America is in tough shape, and we are on, you know, we're on a tough path, and I've discussed this over and over, and I just, you know, politics and religion come together when you start to discuss this stuff. I used to discuss economics separately, but you really can't distinguish between the two. You know, this campaign, when you really look at the top issues that concern people, folks, it's transgender, race, and terrorism. You know, they make it always about something. In the past, it's been abortion, it's been homosexuality. Transgender bathroom rights is among the top issues that people say matters to them in this election. Transgender bathroom rights. And in the same list, racism, okay, or racial struggle, or whatever you want to call it. Okay, I get that a little bit, and I get it a lot, because I think the reality of it is it had smoothed over. There had been a lot of healing in America, and we cleansed a lot of generations from this flawed thought process. But Obama brought severe division with him. He has ginned up controversy and confrontation between minorities and you know, American Caucasians. The real truth of it is, on a global basis, the Caucasian race is now a minority. Globally, it's only, I heard last, like 10%. But we're told that it's a majority, and that's debatable. But Obama has created severe racial division. The last one of all is terrorism. Obviously, that's our true concern. We are at war with Islam. No one wants to say it. The other day I was listening to these audio clips of Obama after every single bombing. Lone wolf, independent radical, never Islamic, radical Islamic jihad or radical Islam, terror, whatever. He just won't say it. He just will not say it. And so this last Saturday we saw the bombs go off in New York. One thing, I don't have a lot enough time, folks, but if you watch the news, first they thought the bomber had two accomplices. They actually have video of, but these two idiots that found a bag with a pressure cooker bomb in it. This is on video right before the bombings. They took the pressure cooker bomb out of the bag or suitcase, put it on the sidewalk, and stole the suitcase, okay? They want to find these guys now to find out more, but think about how stupid that is. They're going to go down in history for stealing a suitcase that had, a bomb in it and leaving the bomb behind. You talk about thick in the head, but I guess that's unfortunately New York. Apparently nothing's safe unless it's bolted down. That one just blew my mind. Unbelievable. The bomber's notebook, interestingly enough, referred to Islamic attacks on U.S. soil. And ironically, he gave credit to Islam and Allah for a bunch of attacks, and this is my perception or insight, that Obama called workplace violence, like the Fort Hood shooting where he said, Allahu Akbar. You know, it's interesting that this terrorist calls those bombing acts terrorism, but our own president refuses to call radical Islam terrorism, which is what it is. He calls them all lone wolves and isolated extremists, which this, folks, is contributing to a rapid spread in terrorism throughout the United States. Acts of terrorism are increasing. They accidentally first said they let 1,000-plus immigrants into the country with a computer glitch. Now they're saying it's almost 2,000. People who had been previously deported, had felonies, serious criminal records. We've got our hands full right now. I mean, we really do. And again, pray for this nation. Know what's going on around you. And in my case, preserve and protect your finances in a biblical, godly, conservative, professional way. We offer wealth and capital preservation counseling or assistance. Precious metals portfolio experts is what, I would refer to our guys. They've done it so long and so well. Bring in, if you've got savings or whatever, bring it in. Let us help you preserve it and protect it. We are, our pricing is so conservative now that we're doing everything in our power to eliminate premiums that come out of your pocket. We have a lot of amazing investment quality product, although we're going through it fast, and a lot of it's just coming out of our vaults. The demand's so high, I'm digging up, top quality stuff that's been stashed away intentionally for quite a while, passing it on to our investor clientele. As I've said, we always offer diamonds as well. Those are good in an investment portfolio. And we always buy scrap gold, jewelry, and diamonds. Coins Plus, 444-0044, toll-free, 877-TAP-COIN. That's 877-827-2646. Or, of course, through our website at coinsplus.com, where you can listen to all the previously recorded radio shows, download them, whatever. We get quite a few hits. We're working on our website. We looked at Google Analytics. There's like 3,950 people a month coming and downloading and listening to the radio shows. So I appreciate that. Honesty, integrity, and professionalism is our motto in everything we do, okay? This is what we do all the time. This is our goal in everything we do. Give us a call, 444-0044, and let us help you build a portfolio. As I've said, 401ks and IRAs, we do them too. So don't be shy, don't be afraid. You want to preserve, protect, and grow, that's what we do. You want to be biblical about it, that's what we do. I believe in it. And I think you should too. So once again, thank you so much for tuning in. Sorry for the technical difficulty at the beginning. Take care. God bless. Have a great evening. We'll see you Friday. Bye-bye.